looks like our
Climate Jobs PDX is Facebook.
All right. So here's Chumbawamba to take us out. It's Paul Rowan with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on political perspectives, Jenka Soderberg looks at the case of Tristan Anderson, who was severely disabled when he was shot by a tear gas canister at a nonviolent protest against the Israeli wall. She speaks with Tristan's partner, Gabby Silverman, for an update on the lawsuit. And at 9:30, we hear an interview with journalist John Pilger about his recent article in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. He describes a new kind of fascism centered in America but based on the big lie of war and aggression. And at 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary hosted by Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, today looking at the criminalization of poverty, also the battle over the continued U.S. militarization of the Koreas, also an update on the health of Mumia Abu-Jamal. At 11 o'clock, it's The Dirtbag. Don Smallman, curator of the Portland Eco Film Festival, talks about gardening-related films in the festival. Other topics include composting, bees, and the importance of hardening off your veggie starts. And, as always, Glenn will answer your gardening questions. Thank you, KBOO members, for your great support. You're keeping community radio alive and well. If you're a listener who would like to become a member as well, it's very easy. You just go to kboo.fm and join up there where it says Donate Today. And we go right now to Political Perspectives with Jenka Soderberg.
We are joined now by Gabby Silverman. She is the partner of Tristan Anderson, who was shot and severely wounded by the Israeli military in 2009. And Gabby, can you start by telling people a little bit about Tristan's story if they're not familiar with what happened to him?
So Tristan and I first went to Israel-Palestine together in 2009. I was 25 years old at the time and Jewish and a leftist and felt embarrassed that I didn't have a clearer sense of really what was going on politically between Israel and Palestine, and really kind of felt then, as I feel now, that, you know, that progressive Jews everywhere in the world, that we have a responsibility to Palestinian freedom, and that it's a problem to kind of bury our heads under the sand and ignore it. And so I went in 2009 in some ways as part of like a coming of age, you know, and felt like it was an important thing to do and I should do it. And Tristan was my boyfriend and wanted to come along. And obviously things didn't go really well for us, and it was more of a coming of age than I really anticipated. But that's kind of how we first got there. But we were there. We did a lot of different things. We did kind of some tourist stuff. We visited my family members there, and we also went to demonstrations every week. There were then and still are demonstrations happening against annexation of land in Palestinian territories and against the occupation, and particularly around the building of this separation wall, you know, that snakes way through Palestinian territory and provides movement restrictions and takes land, and it really brings the occupation up to a whole nother level. And it was at one of the demonstrations there that Tristan was shot. He was shot in the face with a extended range tear gas grenade that was fired by Israeli military police, the border police, at the tail end of one of those demonstrations, and survived, but has a very different life now, you know, resulting from really serious brain injury that happened there. And that was 2009, March 13th, 2009.
This protest was in the village of Nelin. Could you tell our listeners about Nelin and why there were protests going on there?
People who live in this village, it's a village in the West Bank. It's not very far from Ramallah. And it's an agricultural village where people are being cut off from their agricultural lands and where their quality of life is suffering. And, you know, there's just this, like, indignity and continuous, like, escalation that's happening where people who are just kind of trying to live their lives and have families and, you know, are just prevented from having a basic, dignified quality of life. I went to visit the village again during this last trip, and it's really awful. I mean, at the time that we were going to demonstrations in 2009, the wall was still a fence, you know, and now it's a wall. The wall has been completed in this area, and it's really changed everything for what it means to live there.
I understand that on the 6th anniversary of Tristan being shot there, that the protest was held in his honor.
Yeah, it's true. They do something every year on the anniversary of the shooting.
And
so this year they did also, and they, you know, printed posters and people made speeches, and it was very touching. And I felt lucky to be able to be there for it this year.
So that was in March, and you were there as part of the civil trial. Could you tell us about that? What is this civil case that Tristan and his family have brought against the State of Israel?
Sure. So I returned in December 1st of this 2014, and I just came back to the U.S. just about a week ago. So I was there for about 4 months participating in this civil lawsuit. We've tried to pursue criminal charges against the officers that shot Tristan, and that was closed without any charges being brought against anyone, which is very typical of the system, both in the U.S. and also the Israeli system. So the civil trial is the only kind of process that we get. And it was an interesting process on the level of being able to access more information through a discovery process. You know, after so many other doors have really been, like, slammed in our face, we're still able to sue. And so we were able to learn quite a few things through the civil lawsuit. And also on a practical level, you know, Tristan has survived, but he lives with really serious level of disability. And he's never going to be able to live independently or work ever again. And, you know, we're suing for money, not to get rich. Nobody's trying to get rich off of the lawsuit. But the reality is that, like, Tristan had a really severe brain injury. I mean, there's reasons why you really don't want to get shot in the head, you know, and he is paralyzed. He's paralyzed on half his body. He lost one of his eyes, and he has severe cognitive repercussions due to the injury to his brain. Like, he needs 24-hour care, and it's expensive and it's hard. And the U.S. will pay for some of it, but just being a citizen who needs health care doesn't guarantee that you're going to get what you need and doesn't guarantee that you're going to get this, like, a dignified standard of care. So we're counting on the civil suit to help provide for the care that he needs long term and to help provide for a dignified standard of living for him and for his family. And it's a difficult situation, you know. Tristan's parents are, his mother is 68 years old and his father is 74, and they provide most of the care to him. His friends and me, we still help. We're really involved, but his parents provide most of the care, and it's not going to be able to continue this way forever. And so we're suing, you know. And Rachel Corrie's family launched, in some ways, a pretty similar lawsuit, in some ways a different kind of civil lawsuit, you know. But they sued for $1 to keep it a strictly political case. Whereas we're suing for money because Tristan is alive and Tristan is expensive. So this has been some of what's going on with why we're pursuing it.
And what kind of precedent do you think the ruling against the family of Rachel Corrie will have on your case? That was in February. You said there are some differences. She was killed in 2003, engaged in nonviolent action, trying to stop an Israeli bulldozer from destroying a Palestinian home. And the Israeli High Court ruled against the civil suit in February, saying that the Israeli military should be exempted from actions carried out by its forces during what it called wartime activity.
Yeah, it was a bad ruling and a national scandal as far as I'm concerned. And it's not great for us either. Rachel obviously is not the only person who's been killed by the Israeli military. Most people who are killed by the Israeli military at protests and otherwise are Palestinian people. There's a lot of negative precedent that already exists, kind of standard fare, something that happened in Rachel's case, something that happened in Tristan's case, something that happened in the case of, you know, Akil Sroor and Bassam Abu Rahma and Mustafa Tamimi, and like a lot of these cases of protesters being killed is that the military immediately declares the killing to be an act of war, thus releasing them from all legal liability, and then sets out to create absurd, often completely absurd versions of the story of what could have possibly happened to avoid responsibility. So, like, for instance, in the case of Bassam Abu Rahma, who on film was seen shot in the chest with the same weapon that Tristan was shot with about a month after Tristan's extended-range tear gas grenade, which is made, by the way, in the USA. It's an American company who sends this stuff over to them, Combined Systems Incorporated. So what they said in Bassam's case was, where you see it in the video, they said, okay, well, what we believe happened was that the soldiers shot the tear gas in the air perfectly legally, and then the tear gas canister hit like a wire and bounced off of the wire and then on bounce hit him straight in the chest. And this must have been what happened. You know what I mean? It's this level of kind of thing. With us, in Tristan's case, the military has offered three competing theories about what could have happened to Tristan. Theory one, perhaps he was hit with a stone thrown by a protester. Like, maybe that's what happened to Tristan. Theory two, maybe it was a tear gas canister. Okay, you know. But maybe it was protesters who were, you know, shooting tear gas canisters with slingshots. You know, maybe that's what happened to Tristan, you know, and maybe it's in the video that we have of the aftermath of his shooting. You know, maybe it's protesters who you're seeing, like, gassing the medics while they're trying to treat him and gassing Tristan more and more and more. You know, like, maybe that was other protesters who were doing that. And then theory three that they've offered about what could have happened to Tristan is like, okay, yeah, so maybe we did shoot him, but if so, you know, the officers were super far away, standing on the other side of town in a location where there's no line of sight and where it's not physically possible, but would be legal just based on how many meters away the officers would have been standing. You know, a large part of this case, which is, I mean, both sides have political points that we're trying to make, you know, like, but most of the case is actually for Tristan Anderson is a very technical case relating to proper or improper use of a particular weapon that has rules that are supposed to be followed. You know, open fire regulations. What are the open fire regulations concerning the firing of extended range tear gas, sometimes also called high velocity tear gas? You know, were these regulations followed? And clearly they were not. It's not legal to shoot somebody in the face from close range, you know, but we need to establish that. And they're doing every weaselly thing that they can to try to get out of it. I mean, some of it's really absurd. Like, for instance, they even suggested in open court, like, that in this video that we have where you see Tristan, like, on the ground bleeding after he's been shot, you know, that maybe it was somebody else. Maybe it's not even him who we see in the video, you know, because he was shot in the face, you know, so it's hard to recognize him. So maybe they, like, maybe somebody else got shot in the face and they switched clothes or something real quick. And I'm just like there wailing next to some stranger who's wearing Tristan's clothes. Like maybe that's what's happened. It's a really high level of corruption that's involved in the court process there, you know, and we're hoping for a good outcome. We really are. We're hoping for a good outcome. And we have a very solid case. Like I said, it's a really pretty technical case. But there's a high level of corruption, which is why the core is lost. But we hope that we will persevere.
Well, you mentioned that this is a U.S. company that manufactures these tear gas canisters that are manufactured in Jamestown, Pennsylvania by Combined Systems Incorporated. One of the things that the family of Rachel Corrie, who was killed in Gaza, did was to sue the Caterpillar Corporation, which manufactured the bulldozer that ended up killing her. Do you have any thoughts on pursuing the company that actually manufactures these tear gas grenades?
I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, for sure, through this court process, we learned more about the weapon than we knew before. You know, I mean, something that we've learned is that it's a barricade-breaking device, the high-velocity tear gas. It's sometimes called extended-range tear gas. It's the same thing. You know, it's a barricade-breaking device that's designed to shoot at 122 meters per second and hit with enough force to break through walls and windows. And it's meant for indoor use only, you know, and it can shoot, you know, 300 to 400 meters. So it was, like, completely inappropriate to be used at the demonstrations, and particularly even when it is used according to kind of the legal ways, which legally to shoot the extended range gas, you're supposed to shoot high in the air in an arc from, you know, really far away, something like 150 meters away, you know. But, you know, what happens is that the border police, you know, who are there, and the army, they're shooting from close range, often with direct aim, you know. I mean, are we going to go after the company? It's possible. It's possible, you know. But it, I think it all depends. And I think that if there's a lawyer out there who wants to talk with us about it seriously, we would be willing to talk about it, but there's not immediate plans right now. I mean, on a very practical level, Tristan has needs. Tristan has long-term care needs, and we are scrambling to figure out how he's going to survive the rest of his life, you know? I mean, also, politically, it's very problematic, and there's people, you know, it can be that the U.S. and, you know, government and U.S. corporations are acting as such a treacherous force in the world, sending these weapons to, you know, not just to Israel to shoot at Palestinians and anyone else who comes to demonstrations with them, but also they're sending these weapons to Egypt, and they're sending these weapons to Bahrain, and they're sending these weapons to, you know, like just all over the world, particularly the Arab world, you know. And we do have responsibilities, and there's power that we have as Americans to influence American companies and to influence American government. And we should be doing everything that we can. You know, I really do believe that we should be doing everything that we can.
Do you have any idea when you will hear a verdict in the civil suit that has now closed in Israel?
Yeah, the process is a little bit anticlimactic, actually. So at this point, we are done with all of the physical court appearances. And the next step is that, which means that all of the witnesses from our side and also all of the witnesses from the military side have all gotten up to give their testimony already. But the next stage is going to be closing arguments. Closing arguments are going to be submitted in writing in a three stages over the course of the next 6 months. And then after that, there's going to be a period of time when the judge makes his considerations and eventually issues a ruling also in writing. Now, it's possible that we could get, so it's likely that it's going to be something like a year until a judge issues a verdict. It's possible that we could have a settlement negotiation also, and we're hoping for a settlement offer, and it would be appropriate. But so far, the state completely refuses to negotiate with us at all. We've been offered zero, completely zero from the state. And they've actually, you know, the lawyer for the Israeli military, he's a right-wing settler. You know, he's just as political as we are, you know, he's like highly ideological. And he's taken a really hard line, and he has refused to offer anything to Tristan or to his family, irregardless of the fact that Tristan is in a position where he is severely brain injured and paralyzed and needs 24-hour care for the rest of his life. You know, so they actually threatened to charge us court fees. You know, we may actually be charged court fees as if this is like a frivolous lawsuit or something. But we'll see.
Wow. See what happens. And if the judge rules against you, is there any recourse?
I guess we have to take it one step at a time, but I don't know that there is. Maybe we can appeal. Maybe. You know, we're hoping for a good verdict.
Wow. It seems similar also to the case of Brian Avery, although he was eventually offered a settlement. He was also shot in the face by the Israeli military in 2003. Any connections that you see between Tristan's case and that of Brian Avery?
I mean, there are some connections for sure. Brian Avery was also an international activist, you know, engaged in joint struggle. I mean, the demonstrations that Tristan and I were going to, you know, these are demonstrations that are jointly called and jointly attended by Palestinian activists and Israeli activists and international activists, and we all go and march together, you know. And something interesting, by the way, I know it's a little bit of a tangent, but something interesting that came out of our trial, too, is that the military witnesses admitted that, yes, they have different instructions for firing when there are Israelis and foreigners in the crowd, you know, that the open fire regulations are different, you know, when there are Israelis and foreigners versus, you know, how much they're allowed to just shoot people if it's only Palestinians who are at the march. He was shot in the city of Jenin, and it really had a big effect on his life. He was shot with live ammunition in the face, but the bullet took this kind of strange trajectory where it went like up his cheek and through tear ducts and things, and so it gave him a very different face. It really changed his life a lot, but he had no brain injury. So he lives independently and is okay in that respect. He was eventually offered a settlement. You know, I've heard that politically right now, they're like more punishing about the lawsuits than they were a couple of years ago, you know, and they're less likely to make offers. The other thing that's going on now, too, is that not only is there this really hard line about not offering settlements at all, is that the case turned into an excuse for the Israeli military to investigate and smear the left. And so a lot of the case was just about smearing, you know, international activists, smearing Israeli activists, smearing the popular committees from Palestinian villages, just saying outrageous, outlandish things and using it as an opportunity to investigate individuals and organizations. You know, we had a special expert, you know, Ruth Yaron, from former brigadier commander of the IDF, who came and gave testimony about how, like, activists, you know, international activists are, you know, sort of aiding and abetting terrorism by going to protest marches because it makes it harder to shoot people if there's Ashkenazi Jews like me, for instance, who are there, who are marching, you know, side by side with people against the theft of Palestinian land.
Wow. And we'll continue to follow this as the ruling comes down, maybe next year, by the time that this ruling is made. Again, I'm speaking with Gabby Silverman. She's the partner of Tristan Anderson, who recently had his final court hearing in his civil case against the Israeli military. Tristan Anderson was severely wounded and disabled for life in 2009 when an Israeli soldier fired a tear gas canister directly at his face at close range at a nonviolent protest in the village of Nailin in the West Bank. Gabby, thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for the coverage.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
Building a wall between us, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before. Many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep separate the chambers of gas from bulldozers, gunships, and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and honor defiled, to remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distant the terrible sound. of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost, land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people up on their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we feature an interview with from the program Law and Disorder with journalist John Pilger about his recent article in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue.
We speak today with John Pilger, who is one of the world's renowned investigative journalists and documentary filmmakers. He's known for his conscience and bravery and acute historical insight. We talked to him about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine titled Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. Using the word carefully, Pilger describes a new kind of fascism centered in America but based on the big lie and a wars of aggression. We get a historical perspective from Pilger, going all the way back to the end of the Second World War. If you think the wars in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now the Ukraine happened by happenstance, you are mistaken.